Well, welcome, fellow workers, to another exciting hour of Labor Radio here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland and streaming out on the web to all you labor leaders out there at www.kboo.fm. And tonight we have a fantastic show lined up. Sitting in the studio with me right now is Dr. Doug Bigelow. He's here to provide his expertise on healthcare in the workplace, and especially what Canadians have as their kind of health care, because Dr. Bigelow was intimate with that system for a number of years. And also we have Mary Beth Healy. You've heard her here before, our resident expert from Oregonians for Health Security. Mary Beth, who is Oregonians for No Health Security? Would that be the people pushing medical savings accounts? Is
that might be, because those plans certainly don't provide health security. That's
okay.
Going to be true,
well,
Kevin.
Great to have you here. And also, we're going to have coming in a little bit later with his daughter, Don McIntosh. She'll be here. Don, who, of course, is another host of Labor Radio, but also has really done some great work in the Northwest Labor Press on the health care issue and how it relates to us workers. And later on, we'll also be asking you to call in if you have any questions for Dr. Bigelow about Canadian-style health care, or actually he's pretty up to snuff on what's happening in American health care, too. But first, let me tell you who he is. Dr. Bigelow is an associate professor of psychiatry, public health, and preventative medicine at Oregon Health Sciences University. He's also the deputy director of the One Sky Resource Center for American Indian and Alaska Native Behavioral Health Programs. He is a researcher and administrator for Behavioral Health Sciences. He's published over 36 articles and made many more presentations, some of them on health insurance and service systems. And that's how I met him, at a wonderful forum last Wednesday at AFSCME Hall, and it was jam-packed to the rafters, full of labor activists trying to figure out what we do about health care for working people. Not only has Dr. Bigelow been a consumer of Canada's single-payer health care insurance, he's been a provider under that single-payer system at a provincial medical hospital, a university psychiatric hospital, and the Greater Vancouver Mental Health Service. He went back to apprentice for a few years as the single payer in the British Columbia Ministry of Health, where he was an executive director with responsibilities for program standards, evaluation, management information. What does that mean? That's got to be something pretty heavy there. Human resource planning, strategic planning, and all kinds of front page issues. And we'll talk about that front page thing, because I find that very interesting. The front page issues that come the way of executive directors in a provincial ministry of health. Beyond the research literature on single-payer systems, Doug is personally familiar with the workings of a single-payer system, its strengths, weaknesses, and challenges. Dr. Bigelow, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Let's talk about your experience in the Canadian-style single-payer healthcare, because I know as a labor activist, one thing that's been happening in the labor movement in America is all the big strikes over the last few years, all of the major labor struggles we're having, is about this concept of employer-paid healthcare. And a lot of us in the labor movement have looked north of the border and said, you know, things seem to be working up there. I mean, if you look at what GM talks about their vehicles, that they're cheaper to produce in Canada because they don't have to cover these health care costs.
About $1,500 cheaper.
$1,500 a vehicle, right?
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit. Tell us about the single payer, because I think a lot of Americans, and especially a lot of listeners to KBOO and a lot of people who listen to Labor Radio, have heard the term single payer and have heard about this Canadian system, but we really don't know the history and how this whole system came about.
The first thing about the single-payer system is its goals. Its first goal was to remove any financial barrier to the use of health care. That started in about 1947 in the province of Saskatchewan, and I was there. And it has been generalized to all of the Canadian provinces now, where they've also tried to manage cost pressures and have done so successfully, and are focused on providing now the physical and mental well-being of the entire population.
And there's an interesting story about who cooked up, who thought that every Canadian in Saskatchewan at the time needed to have access to health care, right?
The premier of the time was Tommy Douglas, and he had some family history, as most everybody had at the time, of medical need and the inability to get medical care, and that motivated him to move toward an insurance program that would cover everybody for every medically necessary service. 1947, that was introduced in the province of Saskatchewan. There was a major doctor strike, which failed, and the program went forward successfully, and then the federal government picked it up for the rest of the provinces, and by the 1960s, it was in place in all of the provinces.
So, Dr. Bigelow, so did the doctors went on strike against the single-payer system, is that correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting.
And okay, so let's just get our arms around Saskatchewan a little bit, all right? This is one of the big provinces, right? And when we look at healthcare and the way we want to change it here in our country, because there's a lot of people who are fighting for this change, we are looking at incremental change. We're looking at, here in Oregon, you know, we're a pretty progressive state on a lot of issues, and we're looking at trying to change our healthcare system just in our state and maybe export it down the road. And that's exactly what happened in Canada.
Not quite. The United States, we've had a series of Band-Aids,
right?
None of which actually have worked. They've worked in the short run but to reduce the cost growth. But then very quickly people figured out their way around these Band-Aid solutions and the growth went back up again. That's the incremental approach, and fundamentally it doesn't work. The Canadian system wasn't an incremental system. It was only incremental in the sense that one after another province got it. But every province that got it got complete medical coverage. That is to say, the coverage was for at least, by law, 99.some% of the population. It covered them for every medically necessary service. It was portable, that is, it was not tied to their employment nor to their place of residence. It was publicly administered, and it was accessible. People could actually get to the service. And every province that came on board delivered on all of those all at once.
Well, with your experience, there's a lot of myths about the Canadian style single-payer health system, especially in Canada and what's happening there. There's a lot of mythology put out by, I think, the enemies of this kind of program, who talk about lack of access, health rationing, that kind of thing. What's the truth behind those stories?
Well, this is maybe the point to bring up the front page matter that you mentioned earlier. In the Canadian health insurance system, policy is battled out on the front pages of newspapers, radio programs, TV programs, where people bring their complaints, and there are big arguments about how long the waiting list is, and how unfortunate it is that somebody failed to get a service. Where that kind of debate does not happen on the front pages here. That happens in arguments behind closed doors in bargaining rooms. In Canada, the arguments are all up front, and you hear about them down here, including you hear all the political ammunition that is thrown back and forth. That's part of the game. Waiting lists is one of the big things that's thrown back and forth. In fact, waiting is not a serious problem in the Canadian healthcare system at all. It's ones that we like to pick up on down here and say that's what's wrong with it, but it isn't what's wrong with it. It's part of the public debate about whether there's enough, between whether it costs too much and whether there is enough service.
All right.
So, Kevin, can I ask a question? I'm a curious thing. So you talked a little bit about the medically necessary treatments. Can you talk a little bit about how those are defined and how they come up with the list? You know, we had the experience in Oregon with the prioritized list under the Oregon Health Plan. So I'm wondering if this is similar, and I was also just intrigued about the whole college process that...
Okay. Remind me of the college one again.
That you mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, the health decisions process in Oregon is sort of vaguely similar to the way that it's done in Canada. First, in Canada, the Physicians Association sits down with the government and negotiates what's going to be on the service list. And what the rate of payment will be for all of the things on the service list, rather than, and there is an attitude there of, let's make this as evidence-based as we mm-hmm. can. Let's mm-hmm. talk about whether this stuff really works. Oregon was much more rigorous about evidence. Mm-hmm. A list was brought together based on evidence, and then people were saying, where do you want to
draw the line?
Where do you want to draw the line? And the process is not as rigorous as that in BC. There's a budget, it's the services available are negotiated. A great deal more reliance is placed on medical judgment as to what is medically necessary or not. And that works. Rather long discussion about why should that work. It's a cultural thing. But it does work pretty well. Colleges... in the United States, we have associations of the various health professions. In Canada, they have associations which represent the business interests of the health professions, and then they have colleges to whom responsibility for enforcement and regulation goes. That is, there's a College of Physicians and Surgeons, and they are responsible for establishing the guidelines under which their members will practice and enforcing those guidelines and enforcing good practice. So they'll have hearings when there's a question of malpractice. That also has some.
Are those public?
Sort of. They used to be not public at all, but in the last decade or so, while I was up in British Columbia, they began to appoint public members to those colleges. I was one of the appointees for the government to one of the colleges, not the surgeons and physicians and surgeons. So that takes the place of a kind of trade commercial regulation on the part of the government, and it also takes the place of a lot of insurance, liability insurance. They do have liability insurance up there. They do have liability. But the problem isn't anywhere near as big as it is down here, although it's not as big as it appears down here. But it's not even that big up there because much more reliance is placed on the professions college to detect and correct malpractice.
Well, that's a huge question. It's been all over the headlines of our newspaper here about a particular surgeon who was in trouble down in Australia and stuff. And,
yeah, yeah.
And the question's been, how do you judge which physician is the better one for you? And it sounds to me like Canada has figured out a way to do this.
A complaint would have been registered with the college. The college would have called the guy in, reviewed, with some expertise, reviewed his work, and determined whether or not it was malpractice. And they would have suspended his license if that seemed to be the thing that was required to do, or institute some corrective action. For example, the College of Pharmacy monitors the prescription patterns of physicians and dispensing pharmacists, and where it detects, and this is instant. They know the minute you enter your prescription when you're standing in a drugstore what your entire history looks like, and there's computer programs that go through that and say, this guy's getting an awful lot of painkillers, or this doc is prescribing an excessive amount of painkillers, then the college has a little chat with the chap and says, can you explain why you're doing this? Do you understand what the risks are here? We'd like you to sit in on this little workshop so you understand better what you're doing, that sort of thing.
So how do the physicians in Canada view the system? Are they all loading up their BMWs and driving down I-5 to come to Oregon and Washington? Or
No, we have a doctor shortage here, Kevin. Don't you know that?
So I'm just curious. How do they view this system?
It's a good question. By and large, I think physicians are satisfied. By and large, the population is much more satisfied in Canada with its health services than is true in America. Physicians, too, I believe, are much more satisfied than American physicians are, and the reasons are several. One is that they have very, very little administrative hassle. Mm-hmm. The invoicing system is very simple. the services to be covered and the people to be covered is all settled before they even
see the patient.
See the patient, and before they send in their little 3x5 invoice. They know they're going to get paid, and they know it's not going to bounce back and forth unless there's some kind of literal error in it. Unlike here, where a legitimate bill will go back and forth and around and around and around. You'll see copies of it going each way, one right after the other.
Right.
Well, which is an expensive operation.
Oh, it's a huge inefficiency. I have a daughter who's diabetic. And so, it's a very expensive disease to manage, but you can manage it. I mean, we're living in a great time. She's living in a great time to deal with this disease. And it's amazing. I was talking to one of the companies that provides some of her medical equipment, and they were telling me that it takes them over a year to get paid for this stuff.
Ridiculous.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. And I have, I thought about bringing in this moving box of papers that I gather in 1 year just trying to, I have to talk to these people all the time to figure out, is anybody paying you, or what's going on?
That's why docs are much more satisfied. Most docs are more satisfied in Canada than they are here, just because they don't have to deal with that problem. The other reason is because they can see a patient as a patient and not as a source of revenue.
Right.
The patient comes in with a medical problem, and that's what they're focused on. The payment issues will take care of themselves. The same is true for hospitals. And hospitals work on global budgets. That is, they get a budget once a year. They do not invoice per client. They do report how many people they saw in each diagnostic group, how long the stays were, but they do not report the number of Band-Aids used and Kleenex tissues used, and they do not invoice on that basis either. So their overheads are great, and hassles, costs and hassles are greatly reduced. And, of course, those reductions are nothing compared to the reductions at the level of the insurer. The insurer here is the Ministry of Health. And while I was there, we calculated the rates across Canada at about 1.4% of revenues.
That's the cost of providing the service. You're talking about administrative cost of 1.4%?
The administration of the insurance function. There's insurance company administration, right. There is hospital administration, gotcha. There is so there's a cost at each level. The cost at the insurer level in Canada is about 1.4%. In the United States, it's more like 10 times that. And then there are also higher costs of administrative costs for the provider of service as well. And even there are costs for the patient.
Well, you are listening to Labor Radio here on KBOO, and I'm in the air room here with Dr. Doug Bigelow from Oregon Health Sciences University. We're talking about the Canadian-style healthcare system, which he's our resident expert on, and sitting in here with me is Mary Beth Healy from Oregonians for Health Security, and we're talking about the Canadian-style system. I have another question about you. One of the things that I made a little joke earlier about these medical savings accounts, right? That if we, this concept that if you just take charge of your own health care, that you'll do a better job of it. Because the Canadians have a system in which you can go in whenever you want, do they get inundated by people?
A good question. And I like to answer that starting with a question. Do you enjoy sitting in a doctor's office? Do you enjoy getting jabbed with needles?
No.
In fact, people don't enjoy health services very much, so they don't go there just for the fun of it. They go there because it's necessary. It's true that people will go earlier in the Canadian healthcare system, mm-hmm. which is a major cost saving and a trouble saver as well. But inundation, no. They do receive more services. Even although the cost is 50% of our cost, Canadians do receive more physician services and more hospital days. They're not inundated, but they do receive more for half the price.
Within that system, are you allocated a certain amount of days per procedure?
There are no caps. There are no caps for individuals. There are no limits. There are no deductibles. There are virtually no co-pays. there's none of those costs to the person that we are familiar with down here, and no caps, no limitations. Mm-hmm. If it's medically necessary, you get it regardless of how much that comes to.
Well, one thing I find interesting, I have some friends in the healthcare who work in the healthcare field in rural Eastern Oregon, and they tell me that people who are new to the Oregon Health Plan tend to start coming to their office all the time. And it's because they haven't had health care before.
That's correct.
Because they don't understand how to manage their own health care. And it's just kind of sad that we've come this far in this country, that we have a whole group of people now in the, how many million do we have, 44 million in this country, who don't have health care, who really don't know how to use it until they get so sick they have to go to that emergency room.
I ran across an interesting practice up there that bears right on your point of managing your own care. Everybody up there can get the care they need. But as an economy measure and also as a good humanitarian measure, they're always looking for ways to achieve prevention and also self-care. And in this particular case, there were amputees who would normally receive passive health care. They get all taped up, dressings changed, and so forth, by medical personnel. The medical personnel undertook to train them how to care for themselves, how to do their own bandaging, and to do it at home, and so forth. That was not only a cost saver in the long run, but the people were actually very much better satisfied in being able to achieve some care over themselves. That objective is compatible with a single-payer system and much less compatible with our care system. Our care system is much more inclined not to give care at all, mm-hmm. rather than to invest in training people how to care for themselves. Can I come back to a question you asked earlier that I didn't answer?
Sure.
Which was, what about these medical savings accounts? Those medical savings accounts simply do not address the fundamental problems in American health care, and those I'd like to mention to you right now. Because I don't want to just preach
this
single payer,
program has been
but I want to tell you what's wrong
by
with
Caden
our
Foundation
system.
Members
and if
and
you
a grant
spend a lot
Gazelle
of time
natural
thinking about
fiber clothing,
just boil it down
100% natural fiber
to the most fundamental things
men.
Wrong with
real
this
clothing
system.
For real people.
They are lack of access and inability to manage costs. Those are the two fundamental problems in American healthcare: lack of access and inability to manage costs. The savings accounts do virtually nothing to manage costs. The individual patient does not drive up his own costs.
Right.
In fact, in one study, 95% of the decisions about utilization are actually made by the provider, not by the patient.
Right.
So it simply does not address the problem.
Even though we're asked six times every night on TV to ask your doctor if this is right for you.
That's right. They're trying to build up the driver, the patient driver of costs. But in fact, the physicians and hospitals make most of the determinations about what's needed next. You start the process, then they decide what needs next, and then you get into the big bucks.
Well, let me ask you, I hate to interrupt, but right there is there an inherent inefficiency in the American system with respect to what the next step is as compared to what you're dealing in Canada? I mean, is it because of litigation costs? I mean, do we do many more tests, I mean, in our healthcare system than they would do in Canada because of, I mean, does that drive up the cost too?
You're referring to defensive medicine,
right?
It's a driver, but it's not the big one.
Okay.
The big one is the transaction costs associated with a multi-payer system,
right?
Where the payer has to determine in every case whether or not the patient is their patient, and then whether or not the service is covered. And this is the back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, right. And that's perhaps the biggest driver of costs. That and sales and marketing. Each insurance company is out there trying to find out who will pay the most and draw down the least in medical expenses. That is to reduce their medical loss ratio.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money goes into that. A lot of money goes into that insurance-related operation. And that's if we could deal with that problem, we'd go a long ways. And there's only one way, really, to deal with it, which is to come to my bottom line, and the only way to deal with it is to have everybody in the insurance pool and nobody out of the insurance pool.
Right.
There's no question then about whether you're in or out, you're in. and to have a comprehensive, medically necessary set of services already agreed upon, then there's no question of whether the service is in or out. It's already in, because that's what's agreed will be done. If those are fundamental aspects of the solution that would work here, how we implement it, how we design it, may not be quite the way Canada did it. It may be quite different from the way Canada did it. But those fundamental components have to be there if we're going to get control of costs, not to mention access.
One thing that you talked about on Wednesday at this forum as well was the not only everyone in, which just seems like the best goal, right? You solve a lot of issues right there, but also that it's not if there are other services that you want, you still have an insurance industry there. Is that right, or did I?
No, you understood correctly. There is an insurance, a private insurance industry, mainly provided by employers. Mm-hmm. It's called extended benefits. Mm-hmm. It covers things like private rooms instead of shared rooms in hospitals. It also covers dental services that aren't covered, optical services that aren't covered. Some optical services are and some dental are. It covers drug costs that aren't covered. There's quite a bit of coverage for drug costs, but not nearly enough according to the Canadian government itself. They've got to do something about that. So this extended benefits covers a lot of the things that the central coverage doesn't. But the central coverage is really taking on the big financial challenges, and the extended ones are relatively minor.
Botox and, you know.
I'll let you argue that with the Botox prescribers.
Well, you know, one thing we struggle as labor leaders is to educate our members about why it's important for everyone to have health care. And I think one of the great drawbacks we have in the labor movement is we're always fighting, we're fighting to just protect our little turf of healthcare without looking at the big picture and understanding. And what I try to get across to my people all the time is that you're paying for uninsured people.
That's right.
That is part of your insurance program. You must understand that and this particular issue here, healthcare, in the long run, you will understand that you are much better off with a system that covers everybody because you're paying for them right now. And so that's what I want to ask you about also. What's the funding mechanism for the Canadian system? And one interesting thing that you brought up at the forum had to do with the fact that each province sets their own system up per province.
That's right. So that if we were to do the same sort of thing down here, Oregon would have its own health insurance program that would comply with certain federal requirements. That's the way the Canadians do it. And originally, the Canadian federal government paid half the price of every province's insurance program if they met those five principles, and the five principles were universality, comprehensiveness, etc. Who pays for the service? The services are drawn out of general tax revenues, not earmarked funds. I think that's very important because it means that the funds don't get into trouble any more than the big budget does.
Right.
Those general funds are drawn from all the same sources. Our taxes are corporate, payroll, individual. The tax levels are the same for all of those categories, corporate, everybody but individual. Individual's tax rate starts at 25%, which is higher, but goes up to 54%, which is only slightly higher. And sales tax. Sales taxes are generally higher in Canada.
Wonderful.
You know, Kevin, I'd like to just go back to this issue around educating members about the healthcare crisis and the cost aspect. And I just think that it bears repeating that, you know, we are all paying the price. You know, union members pay their taxes, right? So they're paying for public health services that way. And they are paying now $1,128 a year of their premium dollar is a hidden health tax, because that is the money that then goes to pay for the uninsured in our state. So I think it's very important, you know, whether we're talking about revamping the system or supporting public health programs, it makes imminent sense for us to support public health, because we're paying anyway, right?
Right.
And none of us voted on whether or not we want to pay another $1,100 in taxes to fund the uninsured. And I actually bet most Oregonians wouldn't mind so much, right? Because they'd probably see some reduction in their own premiums. But my point is that it's really important for people to recognize that they are paying for it one way or another, and because the uninsured don't go to the doctor and don't get the preventative care that they need and end up in the emergency room or as their primary care location, that's the most expensive place to receive that care, in addition to being incredibly inefficient. That's not where you want to go for a checkup, right?
And that's why it is great to have Mary Beth Healy in the air room. And joining us in the air room right now is another Labor Radio host, Don McIntosh, who has also written some fantastic stuff in the Northwest Labor Press about health care and health care as it relates to the labor movement. Don, welcome to a different chair in Labor Radio.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be here.
Good. So I take join the conversation here.
Well, I'm reluctant to because I'm learning so much about Canada's system. I mean, at some point in the conversation, if we want to talk about, you know, the sort of the tableau of reform options that are being pursued in Oregon and in the United States, I feel like I could be more conversant. But I'm learning a little bit really for the first time about a system which sounds to me would be worthy of adopting wholesale if it weren't for our own political limitations here.
Right. So the funding mechanism is something everybody pays into. They don't have to think about it, right?
Correct.
They don't have to think about it.
Correct. It's simple enough for all of us to understand.
And how do they figure out what the big number is? Like, how much are we going to spend this year? And because what I found interesting is that in different provinces, there's different levels of payment that people have to actually kick in.
Yeah.
Outside of that funding mechanism.
Yeah. The big issue there, however, is not that premiums, which
right.
exist only in three provinces. The big issue there is how much is going to be spent altogether on health care. And that takes you back to the front pages of your newspaper, because that's what the battle is all about. So on to the front page of the newspaper come people saying, we are just paying too much money for health care in this country. And on the other column is somebody saying, you know, we're just not getting enough service. These tightwads are not putting out the bucks. And that's the debate that goes on the front pages all the time. And that's what determines. It's a democratic process that really determines how much money is going to be spent on health care and how much health care you're going to get. It's a democratic process. Front page of the newspaper, the politician who takes the wrong position on that debate loses his office.
You know, I'm glad you kind of brought up the political aspect of it, because I've been hearing a little bit that, you know, there was a change in the federal administration last year or earlier this year.
Yes.
But there's also been like this creeping discussion around privatizing the Canadian health system. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, and what do you think is driving that?
Well,
if indeed Canadians are so happy with the system, why would there even be a discussion about privatization?
Canadians are like Americans. They're a pluralistic society, a lot of different people, a lot of different attitudes, and the freedom to express all of them in any form they like. And there's certainly a constituency of people who would very much like to have the American system as they imagine it is.
Mm-hmm. Imagination's a wonderful thing,
isn't it,
Dr. Bigelow?
It is indeed. The recently elected government includes a component, the former Reform Party, that's very much committed to that point of view. Unfortunately, you have to be careful what you ask the gods, and if you get elected to the government, your position can get you killed and thrown out the next time. So I imagine that they're walking very, very carefully around that. Because for decades, the common wisdom has been he who threatens the people's health care system will find himself on the street in no time flat.
And needing lots of health care, maybe?
And needing lots of health care.
Well, it sounds like what the Bush administration ran into with... remember a year ago we were talking about Social Security?
Yes.
About reforming?
That's right.
Yes.
Whatever happened to that?
Yeah.
Third rail of politics.
Right. I am curious, you know, what do the conservatives imagine the American health system is that they would prefer it?
The party that we're talking about is actually a combination of two older parties. One is the conservatives, and the other is a party that's more like the current administration in its general philosophy. What do they think about the American healthcare system? They think it is a highly efficient system where rich people get the very best services and poor people better pull it together and work a little harder so that they can get them too.
So they got elected? And they missed the whole aspect of an employer-based system and that employers are dropping coverage here because of the high costs.
Well, I don't think they're paying really close attention to what's happening in America. Otherwise, they would be pale.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that.
Well, let's look at those problems. What do you think some of the solutions are to some of the problems we have in healthcare in the United States right now?
Right. Well, the first big solution is to decide. I think of this on the level of principles. I do not advise anybody at this early state of the discussion to talk about plans, just talk about principles. Mm-hmm. The first principle, if everybody, as a result of public conversations, can be clear that everybody in, nobody out, is a necessary principle for health insurance. If we can establish that principle in everybody's mind and everybody committed to it, then we're well on our way already to solving the problem. Secondly, if we can consolidate one of the insurance functions, that is enrolling, invoicing, billing, and paying, into one insurance company per some jurisdictional area, say Oregon, then we'll be a long, long way toward reducing the overhead costs of running health insurance, which are estimated at something like $300 billion in this country. I mean, it's a lot of money going into overhead, into particularly into billing and insurance-related activities. If we can consolidate this is where I sound less like a radical and more like just a regular old conservative businessman. If we can consolidate the buyer's negotiating power in the marketplace, Canada has a marketplace. The payer sits down with the pharmacy company, with the hospitals, with the physicians, and negotiates prices, just like a regular market. But it's the government representing the people as the buyer that gives the buyer the kind of strength that everybody down here is talking about the buyer needing. There's managed competition. It was one example of an attempt to try and give the buyer more power. Well, if we can give the buyer, the whole people, the power to negotiate effectively with the suppliers, then we'll go a long ways to controlling our costs. That it will control first the growth. Costs won't automatically drop down to where they are in the rest of the world. The growth will slow, and then slow to the point where we would at least not get any worse and maybe actually come to the world average. And if we can consolidate the at-risk pool, well, that's the everybody in, everybody out, nobody out aspect of insurance, because after all, the purpose of insurance is to spread risk across all of the people that are at risk, whereas the purpose of the insurance business is to minimize your costs and maximize your revenues, which is a different mission. If you just did those things, now you can call that any health option you want or any program you want, but those, if we were to be committed to those principles and actually achieve something like that, America would be very well served indeed.
And you are listening to Dr. Doug Bigelow, who's here in the KBOO studios here on Labor Radio. I'm joined with Mary Beth Healy and Don McIntosh, and we're discussing Canadians' single-payer health system and what we might do in the United States to try and mimic that system and get everybody under some kind of health care coverage. What, Mary Beth, is happening in the state right now to move towards that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things, and it's interesting, you know, you talk about the principles. One of the myriad of legislative committees that have been set up since the end of the session last August is the Senate Commission on Cost and Access. And part of our homework from the meeting a couple of weeks ago was to think about principles. And they came up, you know, they have a number of different states or organizations that have come up with, you know, varying principles. But I think that's very, very true. And I think that's the dialogue that we're starting to have. And I think that that what former Governor Kitzhaber is trying to do with Oregonians is to come up with what are the principles. So that's one aspect. The Archimedes movement, which is what Dr. Kitzhaber's thing is really trying to think about both the financing of the system, but also, what would a basic level of health care look like. So that's one conversation that's going on. And then we have seven potential ballot measures that would address the healthcare crisis in a variety of ways. There's the AFL-CIO has put forth both an insurance regulatory mechanism that would actually have insurance companies justify their rate increases, which would be a huge big step, and have tons of other information that we as purchasers, I like to say, we need a single purchasing program as opposed to even a single payer, because that's a better way to look at it. And I think particularly for labor folks who understand that collective negotiation, right, this might make a lot of sense. So that's one ballot measure. The other one that the AFL is putting forth is fair share health care, which basically is making sure that all employers are providing health insurance for their employees, and then those that are not above 4,200 employees have to pay 9% of their payroll to provide health care for their employees, or that 9% of payroll goes into a fund that funds public dollars for those workers and their children who are working at that particular employer. Then we have Measure 40, which many of your listeners may have heard about. This has been out collecting signatures for a number of months now. This would define health care as a fundamental right in the Oregon Constitution, and then it directs the legislature, following about five or six concepts, to figure out the plan. Then there's Measure 111, or I should say initiative petition. They're really not measures yet, but initiative petition 111 that would, going to principles, has seven principles of sustainability, and they're out collecting signatures on that measure. Senator Bill Morissette and the AARP have put forth an expansion of Oregon's prescription drug pool, which, just to remind your listeners, actually allows state agencies, local governments, school districts, and some Oregonians 54 years and older and at or below 185% of federal poverty. So you're confused already. Everybody would be in the Canadian system, right? To actually negotiate lower prices on pharmaceuticals. Senator Morissette's initiative petition 122 would actually expand that program to include all Oregonians, regardless of age or income, as long as they had no prescription drug benefit. Then we have an increase in the tobacco tax. This is initiative petition 143, which would raise cigarette taxes by 60 cents a pack to fund coverage for all Oregon children up to age 19. And then we have a nursing home staffing bill that's out, I think, still in the Supreme Court process, but looking to strengthen staffing regulations in our nursing homes here.
Well, a person could spend the rest of their life just trying to figure out what's going on. It seems to me like these are a lot of piecemeal efforts that are trying to move us in the right direction. That 9% rule, wouldn't it be better for us to, rather than have a 9%, to have these statement of principles that says this is what you will do for your workers?
And I want to jump in and say I really like the principles that you advocated, both the ones you shared today and at this forum last week that you spoke at. I think you're right to think that if you start with an approach that you're stating your principles and the details to be worked out later, that's the right way to go. I think one of the problems, I think, particularly with Democrats, is they tend to come out with, my 10-point plan, and your eyes glaze over as the policy wonks, run wild. And whereas I think the Republicans, in fact, do stick to their values and principles, even when the facts belie them. So I think this is one of the observations. I want to maybe just plug this a little bit, but George Lakoff, a sociolinguist, has been pushing, and he's actually going to be on our show next month, April 24th, to talk about how labor can reframe. But I think that's a really valuable insight, that if you stick to a few of the principles like everybody in, nobody out, preventative medicine. Do you want to run down five or six that they...
Universality was the first principle, that is, everybody's in, nobody's out.
Comprehensiveness was the second principle. All medically necessary services, and the people at large determine how big that scope is.
Mm-hmm.
Portability, which means it's not tied any longer to your employment or even to your residence. It goes with you if you are in the defined population, like all residents of British Columbia, for example. Administered in the public interest. In the United States, it's a possibility that this would not be a government insurance program, but maybe some other, what in Canada they call crown corporations, and I forget what we call them, but corporations that operate in the public interest for the public good and have a monopoly on it. So it's administered in the public interest and not in the interest of a particular business. And finally, access, because even although you have coverage for everybody, doesn't mean everybody gets the service, so there has to be a lot of work going into access. So those are the five principles, and they're all written out in greater length. But again, I do agree with your point so much that if we identify the principles and everybody gets agreed on the principles, then tactically we move on to negotiating all of the details, which is where there's going to be a lot of tangling. And if we allow that tangling to be the first thing, nothing will happen.
I do think this also has to happen with probably some kind of a social movement, either that or when the employers wise up. So it seems to me in this country we have a political short circuit in which there's a crying need for something. At this point, you know, there's you know, a desperate situation, 41 million, 45 million, you've got
46.
The numbers, 46 million Americans wholly without health insurance. And a lot of people, frankly, just sick and suffering because they don't have access to health care because they can't afford it. And then others of us, union members, working people, there's a sort of a hidden deduction from our paychecks, which is health care. It ought to appear on every American's paycheck. If your employer is spending $900 a month for your full family health care, first of all, you're very lucky in the sense that you have it, but you're also very unlucky because that's probably $900 you're not getting in wages. It's $900 that's not being well spent. And so it's not being well spent for you. And I just think at some point with the employers cutting coverage so much, when you look at 10%, 11%, 13%, 15% cost increases year in and year out, you cost that out and you're looking at in 10 years' time, 2.5 times what they're paying now. What employer, I ask you, is going to be paying $2,100 a month for full family health care in 10 years' time? I don't see it happening. I think what's going to happen is you see employers shaving off coverage here and there. The deductibles go up. The copays go up. So anybody that's happy right now with their health insurance and says, don't tread on me, I don't care about the rest of you, give them 5-10 years, they'll be very unhappy, and there's going to be a movement in this country. We've got to start getting out in front, I think, and advocating some of the principles of that movement, just for starters, which I don't know if you guys have talked about at all, but John Kitzhaber's Archimedes movement, I think, has done some really valuable thinking work on that.
Yeah. We're getting to the tipping point. There's a tipping point in every phenomenon at which there's enough on the other side of the seesaw that all of a sudden it goes boom. Employers are screaming. Small employers are out of the business. The government is screaming.
Families
are screaming. And I think the critical factor in this is the middle class. Middle class.
Do we still have a middle class?
We still have a middle class. And the middle class is the one that will talk loudest and be heard best. Our last ballot measure clearly demonstrated that people who actually directly benefit from the service will not get out and vote for it. It'll be the middle classes that'll carry this, in my opinion. And we're coming very close to the point where the middle classes realize how deep the trouble is that they're in.
See, I actually think we're there. You know, because of all those issues that you have maintained, the issue, I think, goes to what you're really getting to, Don, and that is people actually getting engaged in this debate. Because without that, It will never happen, because our policymakers, elected officials, etc., need to know that people will, as they do in Canada, right, elected officials will risk their political career if they do not solve the healthcare crisis. And that's what 2006 can be for all of us. You know, we had an opportunity in the 2005 legislature not to solve the problem. That is not at all true, but clearly to make some strong steps forward to at least reducing costs, because you can't I think it'll be pretty difficult to try to expand access without reducing costs and having some accountability and transparency in the moneyed interests of the healthcare industry. And, you know, elected officials in Salem failed. And so we, as voters and the electorate in this state, are the ones that need to hold those elected officials accountable to create the movement, and that will then transfer to the reforms that are necessary. And the principles, what's really intriguing about this, and when you were talking about this, it's like the light bulb went off in my head, because actually I think there's more agreement around those principles than there ever would be, Don, around a specific plan. That's when you get into the bickering and the fighting and people not wanting to give up their financial interest in it. But then if everyone says, oh, yeah, we agree with all of these five principles or whatever it ends up being, then even those moneyed interests are then going to be able to say, going to find it very difficult to then say, oh, yeah, okay, we agreed with the principles, but, oh, wait, that means we also have to give up a little bit, too. And that's a dialogue that has to happen, too, about what we as Americans are going to give up, or Oregonians are going to give up, to get a healthcare system that is sustainable but gets us the healthcare that we need when we need it.
Well, I look at what happened in that last legislature, and Don and Mary Beth, you can probably talk more about this, in which they tried to have one big health plan for all of the education districts in the state, right? And there were some districts that have very good plans that balked at joining it, right? There were some unions who said, we do not want part of this because we're going to have less health care for our people.
In the forum last week, there were some that said, well, if I support universal health care, but if it means I have to give up what we've bargained for. And this is their point, too. I mean, to be fair, or just descriptive, frankly, I mean, the number one issue today in a contract negotiation between a union and employer is health care. For over a decade, some as many as several decades, unions have given up wage increases to get that employer contribution to the health care. Now, again, they're not getting a very good deal for it, but they fought very hard and sacrificed to get that. So the idea that all of a sudden that will be wiped out, there'd be a public system, and that there'd be no credit, I think that's what they were talking about when they met last week's forum, you know, talk about credit. They want, I mean, if your employer is giving $900 a month to pay for health insurance and all of a sudden doesn't have to, where is the power that you would need to get some of that money to be put back into wages or something like that? So I think that, and ironically, in labor's bargain post-war, unable to achieve politically a universal health care in this country, which was shot down in 1947, they basically ended up sort of saying, well, we'll bargain for it individual workplace by individual workplace, and then they end up being removed from the political equation because they've got theirs. Now we're seeing the unraveling of like that, and so like you say, Mary Beth, maybe the middle class is going to rise up. I don't think the poor don't have the clout, the rich are taken care of, so it's going to be somebody. I've been waiting for years, quite frankly, to see big businesses in this country wake up and see they're getting taken to the cleaners by their foreign competition, which has socialized pensions and socialized health care. You can't compete with that when you're a steel company, when you're an auto company that has more retired workers than active workers, and you're paying their health care and pension. I mean, it's absurd, but I haven't seen that. There's an ideological inflexibility that says we can't betray these three in this corner here, and those three are insurance, hospitals, and pharmaceutical. Even though they're 30% of the economy, the rest of the other 70% of employers haven't been willing to betray them ideologically yet and say, you know what, we're not getting a good deal.
But it's coming. I mean, when the CEO of GM, you know, basically calls for a national health care plan in a New York Times op-ed, it's coming. When, you know, when Starbucks spends more on coffee beans, or on health care, excuse me, than coffee beans, it's coming. When, you know, state governments, both as payers and providers of services as well as employers, are screaming, you know what, it is coming. So employers are the key component, and that's one thing that's been very, very exciting, is that business groups are actually starting to weigh in on this issue in a way that even 4 years ago, when I first arrived here, they were not engaged in this issue. So now all of them are working on something or engaging in these other movements, because we can't do it alone, right?
Well, I think one thing that and we're almost out of time, we only have a couple minutes, of one thing that we didn't get a chance to address, and that is the healthcare professionals in this country. Okay, what's it going to take for them to buy into this concept of switching?
Well, I think they're awfully close to buying into it, and there are major movements, the Physicians for a National Healthcare Program within medicine, and many of the new residents are understanding the economics. The reasons they're nearly bought into it, the tremendous overhead costs and hassles that pollute your practice right now are enough to make you buy into it. The costs drive down your net earnings tremendously, and there are more physicians working for managed care companies now than there are in Canada. Canada doesn't have any. They're all private practitioners.
Is that right?
It's very important to point out it's not socialized medicine in Canada. It's a consolidated insurance program. I won't even use the word socialized insurance program. It's a consolidated insurance program. Nobody has to become a socialist to get into this. and the physicians can and do remain private entrepreneurs.
Interesting. And they're widespread. Here we're having an argument in Oregon right now, too, about the distribution of hospitals in our region. Where does the hospital go? Does it include an emergency room?
Does it include a mental health facility?
Exactly, right. How is this addressed in Canada?
Well, that's where we get into a very interesting, rather deep topic called the non-profit business model. As opposed to the profit-oriented business model here. I've got no problems with profit. But we do have a business model here that creates all of those problems of maldistribution because they're going after the revenues, where in a nonprofit, you're really only going after your operating costs. So any society in Timbuktu can set up a hospital and apply for government coverage, and they will get it because they serve the people in that area. Furthermore, any physician who likes to hunt and fish can go out in the boonies and deliver health care and get not only as much per visit as his colleague downtown, but he get a bonus as well, a rural and remote bonus. And if his patients need to be hospitalized, they can be flown into the tertiary care facilities at government expense. So I think the only thing holding the medical profession and other health professions back at this point is their own myths and ignorance. When they individually understand what stake they've got in it, the choice is clear.
And Dr. Bigelow, we expect you to carry that torch for us into the medical profession as we talk to our coworkers here in the labor movement about what's going to be good for them in the long run, about how in the future we have to totally rethink the way that we negotiate our health care and how we should be part of this action. We look forward to working with you in the medical profession to see this happen. I'd like to thank Dr. Doug Bigelow for showing up tonight. It's been a fascinating conversation. Mary Beth Healy from Oregonians for Health Security, which you can find at www.oregoniansforhealthsecurity.org. And, of course, Don McIntosh, who always has the best questions on labor radio. Thanks. And next week, who do we have? Good question.
Well, it would be me, actually. I like to remain topical, so I don't have the agenda planned, but it'll be good, I hope.
Great, great. And thank you for joining us on Labor Radio.